Welcome to the Serious TV Drama Podcast with Scott and Dan. I'm Scott, and with me as always, the game changer to my world breaker, it's Dan.
I want to be the world breaker.
All right. Okay, you can be the world breaker. It makes more sense for you to be the world breaker because you actually venture far more out in the world, at least the continental U.S. than I ever do, that's for sure.
Yeah.
So, you and I, we are here to, what are we doing? We're paying respect, we're recapping, we're reviewing, I don't know. We're doing everything we can to think of when it comes to the season finale of Legion. Before we go any further, just with our usual setup here, were you, just to preview our sentiments about the episode, were you pleased with how the finale proceeded?
Yeah, I'm on board with what they did.
On board. Okay. Much like the Shadow King ended up being on board with Oliver by the end of it. Spoiler.
Yep.
Anyway. I'll say that I enjoyed it. And we'll get more into that as we talk about it later. But first, as per every other podcast we've done, just want to mention a few more thoughts on last week's episode. Now, after I went back and rewatched Chapter 7, one of the things that struck me was that tune that we hear, the Eye, or Walter. I should just call him Walter instead of the Eye, because saying the Eye gets a little bit confusing, I've noticed. Too bad he's not on the show anymore. He's whistling this tune as he's pursuing Kerry Loudermilk through the corridors of Clockworks. And I kept thinking, that sounds really familiar to me. So I did a little research, and I saw that he's actually whistling a tune that's called Froggy Goes A-Courtin'. And it's one of these famous old songs. You can find versions of it by Tex Ritter and Woody Guthrie. But I was like, okay, but I'm not familiar with a Tex Ritter or Woody Guthrie song. Then I realized where I knew it from. And people of a certain age, my age group, maybe a little younger, mostly a little older, will recall an old Tom and Jerry cartoon. It's the one where Jerry's Uncle Picos comes to town. So it's this little mouse with the big cowboy hat and the big walrus mustache. And he keeps singing the song, which they keep referring to in the cartoon as Crambone. But he's singing Froggy Goes A-Courtin'. So if you don't want to know what I'm talking about, go look it up on YouTube, like Tom and Jerry Crambone, and you'll see it. You know, the Crambone. It's the same tune that the Eye is whistling. And something tells me he's probably, when he was a kid, he was probably watching Tom and Jerry, which is just a bizarre thought, I think. So, Dan, in this episode, more specifically, there are comments of the Shadow King is looking for something. He keeps saying, where did he hide it? And I'm assuming we're talking about David's father, you know, who we believe to be Professor X at this point, based on all the details we got in that episode. What is it you think he's looking for? What is it he think he's talking about there?
I'm not sure. I mean, you know, like, there's a variety of options, but I don't really, they haven't given us enough to really know at this point.
Yeah, they haven't really given us any clues about what it might be. So all one can guess is, and therefore anyone who actually is going to venture a guess, it's probably going to be based on knowledge that they have either from, you know, most likely from the comic books or even the movies. It's like one thing that occurred to me was, oh, maybe the Shadow King is looking for that Cerebro device that we've seen them use in the movies, and I imagine that's also from the comic books as well. I can't even remember at this point. Which it's a pretty powerful device, but I was trying to think, would the Shadow King want that or need that? Would it be using it to try to seek out other mutants? I'm not really sure if that would really be the Shadow King's motivation, so I'm just curious.
He's already feeding on a super powerful David, so I don't know if he'd
right.
Really, you know, unless he wanted to, like, you know, go out there and, like, wipe out anybody that could band together to stop him once right. He was fully in control of David.
It would make more sense if it was Division 3 that was looking for that device, maybe. Because they would be looking for other mutants to either recruit or eliminate. But the Shadow King here? doesn't quite make sense. So it's probably not a great theory as to that being what it is, but we just have no idea. But presumably we'll find out something about that in the second season. I think there's an inference in this episode, in Chapter 7, I mean, that due to the fact that Rudy was pretty much near death in the real world, as he was, you know, very slowly bleeding out from that knife wound, that's actually why he's practically a vegetable in the Clockwork's fantasy world. That's like how those two things are connected. Does that make sense?
I could see that. There isn't really any other reason why he would be like that there.
Yeah, why make him a vegetable there otherwise?
Yeah.
Speaking of Rudy, I saw on one of the group pages that we tend to hang out on, someone was commenting on something that we were wondering about last week. They weren't commenting on our podcast because they don't listen to our podcast because they're not a fan of my less than stellar audio or something. But I digress. They mentioned something about the moment about Melanie whispering into Rudy's ear, because we were kind of wondering what that might be. And the person speculated, or asserted even maybe, that whispering in his ear was directly connected to Rudy in the fantasy world actually tackling the Shadow King. And I could see there being some connection there, although I don't think Melanie would have been aware what was going on in the fantasy world at this point, that she would know that the Shadow King was stalking and about to even kill, what was it? It was Sid, actually Rudy and, but more Sid and Kerry at that point.
Yeah.
But I guess it does make, I feel that there has to be some connection because we see that happening and then, you know, moments later he tackles her. So I guess there's some connection. But it may have been just a general one or something. I'm not sure. Maybe it just inspired his actions in the fantasy world or something. Trying to think of anything else here. We probably mentioned this joke, but it made me laugh just watching it again. I love a show that's not built on humor necessarily can still bring the funny. The fact that the British accented rational mind persona of David has that real strong reaction to David's imagined British accent of his dad was probably one of the funniest things in that episode, I thought. I did think it was somewhat significant that when they come out of the fantasy world, when it's become reality again, that Sid is still continuing to touch David. I mean, she is wearing her gloves, so it's, you know, it's safe. But even that, she tends to be somewhat averse to. It's very rare to see her make any kind of contact with anyone, even with the gloves on. So at least it shows that she still can have some, or she still believes she can have some level of intimacy with David, even if, you know, there has to be fabric in between them. And then at the end of the episode, I don't know why I didn't catch this the first time. It's just one of those lovely little character moments. I love that Oliver continues to sip his martini despite being surrounded by the Division 3 soldiers at the end of the episode. He's so wonderful. Okay, unlike previous podcasts, there wasn't really that much I felt wanted to talk about from the previous chapter because we talked so much about it last week.
Oh, yeah.
Plus, let's be honest, I think we've kept everyone, including ourselves, in suspense long enough. So we should start talking about the end here. In other words, the season finale, or Chapter 8 of Legion. Now, what I think we'll do is talk about the episode, but as we go through it, you know, we'll just go back and forth here. I did notice, you know, right off the top, that this is the first episode written by the creator, Noah Hawley, since Chapters 1 and 2. And for me, in a way, it was probably closest to a return of the feeling of Chapter 2, if that makes any sense. You know?
Yeah.
Which, you know, looking back on that one, that Chapter 2, you know, was a very solid and, or even, you know, really, you know, a good episode, but it wasn't quite as head-spinningly insane as that pilot was. And we were, maybe for that 1 week, we were almost misled thinking, oh, it's going to be totally conventional from this point on. And then right after that episode, it certainly wasn't. But Chapter 2 certainly felt that way. And to a certain degree, and, you know, and I mean, I hate using the word conventional about a series like this, but I think this finale and Chapter 2 are actually the most conventional episodes of the entire series. Would you go along with that sentiment or not?
Yeah, they're pretty structured and linear, more so than a lot of the chaotic middle episodes.
Yeah, I mean, when you put this one up against even, like, especially like the last one, or the last couple for that matter, it's really something. But, you know, that isn't to say, you know, it's not formulaic here. I mean, there are elements about this episode that are somewhat unconventional. I mean, for example, it's the rare season finale that really takes its time. And also, in a change of pace for shows that are just on FX, not to mention any Noah Hawley series, they didn't go full bloat with this one, which a lot of series finales tend to do. I mean, I was expecting when I put this one on, it was going to be another an 80 or 90 minute episode, and it only goes a little bit over the hour, if I recall.
Yeah.
You know, but it's nice that, you know, instead of rushing to move pieces around the board for the big battle or the showdown or whatever, Hawley does throw us off here. I mean, he's not just taking his sweet damn time with it, but the fact that we open by focusing on the story of a character I doubt any of us gave any thought to since chapter one, or at least until he appeared at the end of last week's episode, where we learn all this information and backstory and what's been going on with the interrogator. Or actually, now we know his name now. His name is Clark, so I can finally call him by name, Clark. I think actually maybe even half of the entire first act, maybe more so, is spent, you know, with that melancholy harpsichord playing. I kept thinking Oliver would probably love that. On discovering what happened to Clark, his convalescence, his recovery, you know, with the burns. We discover he has a husband and an adopted child, how even he has to deal with the bureaucracy of the government to get back into field work, and how he graduates from rehabbing with a walker to using that wolf's head cane, which seemed really familiar to me, like I'd seen that somewhere before. So in a way, it was kind of a ballsy way to start the season finale, I thought. You know, because, you know, you'd think we'd be like, wait, let's get back to where we left off. But it's like, no, we're going to make you wait just a little bit longer. It kind of vaguely reminded me of something they did in one of the episodes of Fargo, I think in season one, where you were kind of thrown off for the first part of the episode. It's like, wait, what's going on now? And then we get back to the storyline.
It was kind of cool that they spent all that time building him up, and then just like, you know, 10 seconds later, David had like completely incapacitated his entire team and he was like captured. And so I thought that was pretty funny that they did that.
Oh, yeah. I mean, the fact is he totally out-Rudies anyone with telekinetic abilities. Oof. In that scene. He just mentally sweeps up all the soldiers into that big, it's like an undulating column of scrambling men. I had the thought that he's lucky that the Shadow King wasn't in control. Because I got a feeling that would have been a much more horrific scene of all those guys. Oh,
yeah, that would have been a meat grinder for sure.
I think it would have been exactly a meat grinder, you know, just based on what we saw happen at the Division 3 headquarters in that other episode. I also thought it was interesting that one of Clark's eyes has now got that whole milky eye look to it. Much like what we saw Walter the Eye have. I mean, there's definitely been a recurring image of eyes throughout this series. And, you know, eyes that, you know, may be blind but can actually see so much more. And we do discover that's the case with Clark's bizarre-looking pupil there, that it's a camera for Division 3. So we get those moments throughout the episode where you have that whole little weird gaggle of soldiers and generals are watching. And I love that we find out that Clark's husband, who looked like such, you know, a sweet, loving dude before. Oh, he's part of all this also. But it's kind of neat that, you know, David just wants to talk to the guy. And what they do by having the episode open this way, and then the little bits we get with Clark throughout the episode, he becomes less and less the quote-unquote standard villain, and he becomes more, I would say, understandable or even reasonable as far as what his motivations are. I mean, throughout the episode, when he talks like with Melanie and everyone else about why Division 3 is doing what they're doing, you can kind of see their point. I mean, there's a whole conversation about, well, you're gods. You know, you kind of get where they're coming from. I know that's a story type of storyline we've seen in both DC and Marvel universes, cinematic or comic book or whatever, about trying to control or, you know, deal with people with superpowers. But based on what Division Three has seen and what we've experienced, I think I don't know. I can't say they're certainly not the good guys, but maybe they're not quite the evil guys either that we've kind of painted them to be. If that makes any sense.
No, yeah, I definitely agree that they came off as more reasonable than we usually see this kind of organization in this episode, anyway.
Yeah, right. You know, I mean, it remains to be seen when we get to season two how much that's going to change. Whether it's an uneasy alliance and they're still out for themselves or not. I would assume it's going to be the case, but it's not Hydra. You know, they're part of the U.S. government. They're just like a more clandestine version of S.H.I.E.L.D. or something, as far as I can tell. While you've got all that going on, you still have this whole thing with David is still grappling not just with his powers, but whether or not he was ever schizophrenic. Because, you know, with all those years in Clockworks, it's probably all the years that led to his confinement. You know, he was constantly being told that he was sick. I kind of was wondering about that, and I'm thinking, you know, there still may be the... I still think that David actually does suffer from some level of mental illness. I don't think it's just, oh, he's got powers and he's been deceived by everybody, been almost like gaslit by everybody all these years. I think there may be something to it. I mean, do you think he actually does suffer from any form of schizophrenia, or do you think it's just although we haven't seen in this TV show that he actually absorbs people's thoughts or personalities the way I think you've told me the comic book character does. Where do you fall on that as far as is David, you know, mentally okay or not?
I think I'd have to see more of him without any Shadow King influence to really know one way for certain. But there definitely are plenty of times where, you know, he doesn't seem to be affected by the Shadow King at all. He at least has, you know, mania going on. Right. So I'm not sure. So, you know, yeah, probably something going on.
Well, it's interesting because he says that he's become sick of himself. So now what he's doing, he's trying to save everyone else. And, you know, whether that's just Sid or the other mutants or even the entire world. What I thought about it, like, it was kind of an interesting realization for someone who, for most of his life, or at least his adult life, I mean, we're talking about beyond being an introvert. He's kind of been trapped within himself. Either he's being shouted down by the voices in his head, and he's been suppressed by everything from the hospital medications to, well, the biggest thing of all, the parasite living in his brain or mind, whatever. So in a lot of ways, this one episode, this David that we're seeing, I think he's trying to understand what it really is to be a fully functional person, a fully actualized personality, free from all those things, especially and specifically, you know, the parasite, the Shadow King, Lenny, or I never call it Farouk. Farouk would be easier than all these other things. I should just call it that. But yeah, so I think you're spot on. We haven't had enough time to experience David as David. And the closest we get to that is maybe some of the moments with Sid, but in a weird way, I think those are also kind of like, what's that phrase? Rose-colored glass kind of moments where, yeah. You know, because we're also I think in those scenes quite often, we are sort of seeing David through Sid's eyes. And she, obviously, I think she's also created a somewhat more, not glorified.
Idealized.
Yes, that's exactly. She's created a more idealized version of him, which makes sense because, well, she's in love with him, and I think we've agreed.
Oh, yeah.
That it's probably her. I think it's probably her first true love. You know, and even if it's not, it doesn't matter. It's our current love, that's for sure. So. Getting back to just the overall ensemble, I did like that you know, a couple episodes ago we got to see how each, you know, member of the team had, you know, completely different types of perspectives and situations going on in like the Clockwork fantasy world. So even here, when they're dealing with Clark the Interrogator, everyone's got an opinion, everyone's got a different point of view, everyone has a different dog in this hunt, or whatever that corny ass phrase is. Because, you know, like I keep saying, David just wants to talk to the guy, but Melanie wants him to read his mind to find out about Division 3. Tonomy wants him to kill the guy, which leads Sid to wonder, you know, question, is that what we've become now? And the one who's probably the most rational about things in this during this whole that whole sequence is probably Carrie Loudermilk, because he's not even really thinking about the interrogator at all. He just wants to get the parasite out of David's head, because that Halo doohickey is starting to fail just a little bit. And considering what they've just gone through, maybe that really should be priority one, as opposed to, you know, the guy with the cane in the other room. But I think throughout the entire episode, there are several debates that happen. So even though we do get, you know, a splendiferous, you know, action moment later on, I think for the most part in this episode, dialogue acts as both conflict and character. Whether it's Melanie sitting down with Clark or the Loudermilks having that ridiculous but funny spat right in front of Clark, which is probably one of my favorite little moments in the whole episode, because it's one of those, I wouldn't have expected them to do that. You know the scene I'm talking about? Of course you know the scene I'm talking about.
Yeah, yep.
Well, by the way, going back to how the fascinating idea of making Clark a more sympathetic character, since he had been the villain before, in a weird way, in that moment with the Loudermilks, I kept thinking, we're kind of getting the Clark, looking at this from the Clark point of view. Because, like, when he says he seems nice about Carrie, don't we kind of agree? It's kind of, he does seem perfectly nice in that moment.
Yeah, even though they're definitely, I mean, they were doing something there with that glass of water. Like, I don't know what they were trying to show, but there definitely was something unsettling going on there. Maybe he has some kind of ability, like, you know, himself, and we just haven't seen that, which would make sense, you know, for him and Walter to be teamed up and kind of in higher ups in this department. Potentially they both would have some kind of, you know, be mutants, whatever.
Yeah, I was trying to figure that out with the water, the way they were focusing so much on it. It almost made me think of like that Hitchcock movie. Which one is it? Is it Suspicion? Yeah, Suspicion, when Cary Grant's walking up the stairs and it's focusing on that one glass of water. I think it's water, which is glowing eerily, even though it's black and white, it's still glowing because they put a light under the tray. And we're supposed to wonder, oh, is it poison or not? And you never really know for sure if it is or not. And in this scene, it's the reverse. It's not, do we think that the Carrie Loudermilk has done anything to this beverage? This seems to be more of a concern. Can Clark use this as a weapon or something? But I'm not really sure what he can do with it. But they certainly spend a lot of time in that moment with it, that's for sure. But I just love that in the midst of this overall crazy storyline, which is careening towards its conclusion, that we would have time for a moment like this, you know, the Loudermilks and their issues, and, you know, just Bill Irwin is just so, so good. And I think maybe we might have even overlooked him a little bit, because I think we tend to concentrate more on the flashier work by people like Aubrey Plaza and Jermaine Clement. But Bill Irwin is one of the standouts of this series as well, for sure.
Oh yeah, he's just been great. I'd say, and I'm worried about everything, but I'd say him being so good in this retroactively makes Interstellar better, since he does the voice of one of the goofy, flippy-looking robots in that movie. So, like, that may just, like, thinking back on that, just like, oh, that's cool, you know, this guy's awesome, it's cool, like, seeing him play, like, kind of an asshole robot. You know?
I still will not go back and watch that again, but I'll take your word for it. Oh, and speaking, since I just mentioned Aubrey Plaza, you know, after David does a little John Lennon homage, you know, actually, I would say he does an homage to John Lennon and the parasite that was living off of him, you know. Oh, I'm kidding, Yoko. She's not listening. When he says, "War is over if you want it." He's got that moment where he keeps saying, "You don't have to be afraid," over and over. Did you think that something was really horrific was going to happen, since he kept repeating it over and over? I kept thinking something really bad was going to happen in that moment. Did that occur to you at all, or is it, you think it was just going to be silly?
I thought he was trying to, like, Jedi mind trick him, and it wasn't working, and they were just being funny. I mean, they definitely were making it, like, seem like it was going to be some intense thing, but I think it ended up being more funny than anything.
Yeah. Doesn't Clark even say, you keep saying that, or someone says it. I think it's not. But during that, we all of a sudden were spending some time back in the White Room again. But this time it's with Sid and Lenny. I mean, or Farouk or Shadow King or whatever. But Lenny, who looks like she's rotting and oozing tar. And it occurred to me, like, we had to have at least one more scene or confrontation between those two. because it's like they've been at war for David's soul in this series. Wouldn't you say, I mean, that wouldn't you say that's kind of a somewhat accurate way to describe that?
Yeah, I'm cool with that.
Because in fact, I think it's the introduction of Sid that really sparks pretty much the entire chain of events from the early going-ons at Clockworks to now. I mean, if Sid doesn't show up there, I don't think any of this happens. I think he's just still in Clockworks, just, you know, doing the meds, doing everything else. I don't think anything else ever happens. So she's really the, I don't know, she lights the fuse. She's the accelerator, the catalyst. The
catalyst, yep.
I forgot the phrase that writers are supposed to know. And and Sid, still one of my favorites, because when she can pull off the line, like, your Lenny mask is running, which I really enjoyed that, you know, whereas before her reactions to Sid or the Shadow King when he, you know, had been mostly, you know, scared out of her mind and just, I like that she's kind of got more of a backbone here and she's really standing up to whatever it is.
Yeah, it was pretty sweet seeing Sid have the upper hand here instead of just like the usual, like, you know, oh, I'm in distress, oh, somebody save me, that we've seen so many times.
Which even though in that one scene in an earlier episode, it's kind of understandable, but once is one thing. I didn't want to see it happen again with that character because she's a pretty kick-ass character otherwise. She may not be Carrie Loudermilk kick-ass, but she certainly got a fucking iron spine. So she's certainly going to speak up for herself and defend her man, as she would say. But we do find out one really important thing here, that because Lenny makes it clear that the only way for David to survive without him, her, it, whatever, being part of him, is if he leaves willingly. So I think right when we hear that, we can already foresee some aspects of what's going to be inevitable here, I think. Now, shortly after, it was interesting that Sid, not, you know, believes Lenny, she decides to reveal the truth behind the parasite in the room with Clark there. I mean, to Clark, in fact, which we know means that Division 3 is also hearing all this because, you know, the camera eye thing. So it's interesting because Sid seems to fluctuate for being, well, she's certainly the most savvy character at times, but she can also be kind of charmingly naive, if that makes any sense, because she does assert here that Clark actually does like David and would want to help him. I would say I kind of agree with her there, because I never get the feeling that Clark he doesn't have that hate, that typical mustache twirling hatred of certainly of David that you'd expect from certain villains. But shortly after this, I mean, even though we probably don't have the time or energy to pop it on our own little podcast soundtrack, come on, you had to love the fact that they actually use some Pink Floyd here.
I don't like Pink Floyd, actually. I've never found it to be the least bit enjoyable. But it must be maybe like everybody around me that's ever listened to them has just been fucking stoned out of their mind losers their entire lives. So that might be an unfortunate connotation and diminishes my ability to appreciate the music. But but it was used well in this episode.
Fortunately, one of us does love Pink Floyd because I grew up with it and playing constantly in my house. And you think I would hate them at this point. But Dark Side of the Moon has always been one of my favorite albums. And hearing Breathe throughout this entire sequence, which is, I guess it's all about David's experience in the Loudermilk lab and that extraction process that Carrie and Oliver are attempting. Which, visually, it's interesting. It kind of sends David into what looks like, I would call it the projection booth of his mind, because it's more like he's watching movies and experiencing the memories that are both real and imagined, or rewritten for that matter. So, it's a sequence. It's surreal, but it's not really quite as wow, mind-blowing as some of the sequences we've been getting in previous episodes throughout the series. I mean, it's certainly something, but it just, I wasn't like, oh my gosh. It was like, oh, okay, that's nice. I was more interested in the music, actually, than I was in what I was seeing.
Yeah, it kind of seemed like an editing room to me, and it would have been cool if, like, they actually, like, you know, made it look like an editing room or something, and just, like, you know, just to be really, like, bonkers and just have, you know, David twisting a dial or something and just like, you know, sliding off, like, you know, cutting out that kind of thing. That would have been kind of fun. But.
That would have been a nice kind of a meta moment for them to have pulled off. Because that would actually be kind of cool. That would have been neat.
Plus the editing on the show is so good that they, you know, whoever did that probably would have been, you know, just like, oh, this is fun.
They could have even had a cameo. Dear Noah Hawley, why didn't you?
Oh yeah, have the actual editor of the show like do the editing like on screen.
but we do end up getting that little marvelous fate. Like, I want to say face off, even though they're not really facing each other for part of it, between David and I'll say evil Lenny here, who kind of looks like a zombified Edward Scissorhands at this point. And that's where things start to go a lot more haywire than they have in the episode at this point, which eventually leads to, cutting right to it, that where Sid lays one of those magic kisses on David, which essentially makes her the next vehicle for the Shadow King. Just before that happens, it did occur to me, and again, it might have been mentioned in the dialogue, and because I only watched the episode the one time, maybe upon a rewatch I'll hear Carrie say it or something, or Oliver maybe. I wasn't really sure where the Shadow King was going to go if Carrie and Oliver were successfully able to drive it out of David. Did they mention if there was some sort of containment thing set up, like kind of a Ghostbusters-like thing or something else? Because they never indicated that they would actually be able to kill it. It was all about just getting it out of David. But it's going to have to go somewhere.
There. Yeah, I thought they were trying to shoot it into like whatever kind of, you know, anomaly that opened in the air above David. Like they're going to like suck it into some like, you know, pocket dimension, black hole, whatever.
Okay.
It seemed like when that like flash of blue, bluish whatever opened above David, that seemed to be when like shit started to get real. But you know, there was so much crap going on there. And plus, you know, listening to Oliver and Carrie talk, I mean, they're you know, they're not exactly being super literal about the stuff they're doing, especially Oliver.
Well, yeah. I mean, Oliver, who constantly talk about a guy who goes off on tangents out of nowhere all the time. He's so great. So, anyway, you know, the Shadow King hops aboard Sid for a few seconds before being transferred to a more, let's say, a more efficient fighting machine, which would be Carrie Loudermilk. And she just, like, kicks ass in all sorts of ways. But the most startling thing, which really kind of almost, I think saying frightened me might be an exaggeration, but kind of startled me, I guess would be a better way to put it. When she does that little point and shoot thing at Melanie, because for a moment there I thought, did she just kill Melanie? And what power is that? And I realized, oh wait, that's the Shadow King has that ability. We've seen that she can pretty much do anything, the way she crumpled up, you know, the eye of that other episode. So I was right. Frightened that she had just killed Melanie for a moment there, which would have been kind of a shocking death, I think.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I wonder what powers we see David have, like, are actually powers that he had or just ones that the Shadow King had, if the Shadow King can transfer those, you know, those specific telekinetic powers.
Right. How much of it is it, you know, David's, or what abilities did the Shadow King have itself? I mean, I kind of think that's something that was just a Shadow King kind of thing, but you wonder, does David have that ability too? Because it seems like in every successive episode, oh, David can do more. Oh, he can do more. I mean, just the fact that he can float and fly is something, quite frankly, as we see him doing in this episode. But this all leads to that big showdown, because as you know, the Shadow King, as Carrie and David kind of charge right at each other. And, you know, as Oliver says, you know, boom goes the dynamite, which is kind of an odd reference for Oliver to make, but whatever. But the result of that massive collision, it sends this wave of, you know, wispy, evil, ethereal, whatever it is, the entity that was forced out of David and now forced out of Carrie, I guess, is out in the open. And it tragically finds Oliver as its next host. And it's just, you know, like a minute after Oliver finally remembered who Melanie is. So Oliver is fascinating to me because on one hand, in many ways, he's been the funniest character on this series. But in another sense, he's also been, outside of maybe David himself, but even more so, I would say, he's been kind of the saddest character on this series, and this just played up the, you know, the tragedy that much more, I thought.
Yeah, but the good thing is we will definitely be seeing more of Oliver, so hopefully we'll have, you know, lots of opportunity for him to shine, and more Abbey Plaza.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I love the fact that when we were watching this series earlier on, you know, whatever the earlier chapters were, I mean, I didn't know or expect that Oliver would be not just a recurring character, but he was going to be end up playing a major part throughout this series and going into the next season. And I also wasn't sure if Aubrey Plaza... Remember, we didn't know if Aubrey Plaza would make it out of the first couple episodes?
Yeah.
And then she turns out just to freaking take the whole damn thing over by the time it's all done. So one of the great things about this finale, as far as the setup for next season, is the fact that you took those two characters and those two actors, you know, Aubrey Plaza and Jermaine Clement, who have turned in some of the most interesting and hysterical work on the series, and now you've put them together, and that's going to be next season. I'm looking forward to those scenes more than anything right now. You know, just that little moment of them in the car together at the end alone was like, oh, can you give me just another 5 minutes of this? You know, I just want to hear that conversation.
Speaking of that moment, what do you think that means that, you know, that she kind of has a Japanese look there, and he definitely thought his like wife at some point in the, you know, was Asian. Do you think that that means at some point Farouk like had possessed him for an extended period of time?
I think what it is now that it's in possession of him or in him. I mean, obviously it instantly knows everything that's gone on in his head and his memories and whatever. So that's the look it's adopted to fit in with him. I mean, it's funny because I didn't even think that much that was quite what she was going for there. I actually was thinking, this is the most Aubrey Plaza-like look that she's had in the entire series compared to the previous, you know, 8 chapters. This is the way she looks more like in real life. But yeah, you're right. There is a certain, I don't know. Is it Japanese? I don't know. I don't want to pick the wrong culture.
I believe it's Chinese.
Chinese. Okay, that makes a lot more sense because I can't remember when he says earlier in another episode when he's trying to remember who his wife might be, and he asks, "Was she Asian? Was she Chinese?" It's definitely, because so now it's going to be feeding off of him. I think it's definitely just tapping into that. I don't think he had been part of him before because they had encountered each other, but I don't think he was ever in possession of him because how the heck would he have gotten him out of him? You know?
Yeah.
So, what else happens here? I just want to make sure I don't lose my brain spot here. Oh, well, actually we're pretty much at the end of the episode because, you know, obviously Oliver departs, you know, with Aubrey Plaza in the car, and it looks like they're going to be heading someplace warm. So I'm assuming that means the search continues for whatever it is the Shadow King was looking for. That's what they're talking about here, is why they're going somewhere warm, or as David later says, they're heading south, I think. So beyond that, you know, we do get that moment between David and Clark where David believes they're going to have to work together now, and Clark seems to agree. Although I was wondering, you know, at that moment, you know, he says he'll talk to him. His camera eye is still working, so other than the brief moment where he's probably knocked out when Carrie threw him, you know, across the hallway or something, I think they had said that they were sending like the Equinox there, some sort of we didn't know what right. That was. Now, the end, which was this post credit scene that hopefully everyone saw, because I didn't realize it was going to happen until you mentioned it online, and I had fortunately paused my TV during the credits. I was like, oh, I guess I'll keep playing them now. So I was like, oh, I finished my notes. It's like, oh, there's something else. Do you think that sphere that scans David and basically transports him inside it, do you think that's the Equinox thing that was sent out, or do you think it's something else entirely?
I'm 50-50 on it. I think it could be that because, you know, they mentioned something and we didn't see that payoff. You know, Chekhov's Equinox there, but
nice.
But or it could be something different than the setting up for next year without giving us anything to do except just you know, no information. We just got a muse. It's definitely like more advanced technology than what we've seen District 3 have so far.
Right. I mean, my my first instinct is to say that's it was this equinox thing, because we have several scenes throughout the episode of, you know, them, they're gonna do something. Oh no, we'll give him another hour. Oh, we'll give Clark another hour, or whatever. And then finally, they make a decision, like, you know, to institute this program or whatever the heck it is. We don't know what it is, and nothing ever happens except for this. And I said, okay, that's gotta be what it is. The only factor against that is when David's out on that balcony with Sid. It seems like a significant amount of time has passed, and whatever Division 3 would have had up its sleeve, you think it would have happened a while earlier. So that's the only thing that works against the theory, I think. But much like everything else on the show, it's not really clear how much time has passed. And much like it's not really clear what the time period is of this show. I mean, they keep making references to things that are kind of modern. So maybe it's the 90s. Maybe it's whatever.
Well, yeah, because when Clark was rehabilitating, he was using remote controls, and I think in the 70s, what they had for that, I mean, still were kind of wired, so I'm not sure.
You had regular remote controls by the 70s, but they were much clunkier looking. But I mean, I've said before that I feel that they've kind of established that this show, if you were going to try to pinpoint a time period. At best, I would say it's supposed to be the 90s, because they mention Oliver being in the frozen place, whatever, for 21 years, and his look, his manner, screams, you know, late 60s, early 70s, you know, with the whole leisure suit look and the way he talks about, you know, beat poetry and whatever. So and Morton, actually, what really pinpoints the time even more was that other episode when we see Tanami's mother pass away, and he mentions that she was singing 99 Luft Balloons. Well, 99 Luft Balloons, and he's a little kid when this happens, and that song came out in, whatever it was, like 83, 84, around that time in the U.S. So, again, if he looks like I don't think they say how old he is, maybe he does. He's somewhere between like 7 and 10, I think, in that scene. And if we assume he's at least in his mid-20s in this episode, so again, you fast forward 10, 12, 15 years, it again puts it into the mid to late 90s. So that's what I'm going with until anyone says otherwise. You know, and then there's another episode, Amy mentions email. So email is mentioned in the episode, in one of these episodes, which also is a, you know, puts us into the, at the very least, into the 90s. So that's my thinking. So that's pretty much it. We end the whole series with a couple cliffhangers, a couple mysteries here, which I expected no less. we knew that they were going to get another season. We knew that a lot of things would not necessarily be resolved, even though I think they actually did a good job of really completing one major storyline as well as opening the book to entirely new ones. Right? That kind of makes sense.
Right, yeah.
And thus will actually be interesting going into season two, what we were talking about earlier, about just what kind of character David will be now that he's free from this parasite and free from, you know, thinking he's a total lunatic. So we'll see Dan Stevens is the name of the actor? It'll be interesting to see what his performance looks like next season, because I would think there should be some differences at certain points, since he's had to play, you know, this troubled character in so many different ways this season, I think. So my feeling is I think they did a good job wrapping up the season. I was very pleased with it. It looked great, sounded great, you know, much like every episode. I didn't expect the finale to be my favorite episode of the series, because that's usually the case for most series that we talk about over the years. I mean, outside of your occasional Breaking Bad episode, quite often the last episode isn't really the best one. Which was your, now that you've watched all eight, which was your favorite chapter? Do you have one in mind?
Yeah, probably last week. It's kind of hard to top that.
That's my feeling too. So it totally became the, oh, it's the penultimate episode is the best one here. That's my favorite as well, because I now think that was the best melding of character, story, plot, and holy crap in one episode.
Yeah. But I enjoyed this episode. I thought they didn't really resolve. I guess all they resolved was the Shadow King being within David storyline. But I thought they did that. They handled that really well, and it was fun and exciting. And they had some really cool sequences that, you know, were very had me enraptured by the what I was seeing.
Oh yeah, I'm not trying to be overly critical about the episode. I still enjoyed it quite a bit. I really liked it. Let's not kid ourselves here. I just felt it wasn't as good as like the penultimate one. No, but who cares? It's like what we say about Game of Thrones all the time, and you know,
yeah, Game of Thrones. Yeah,
you know, Game exactly. of Thrones is like the best example. It's usually episode 9 is the really memorable one. It's rare that the finale is as good. I mean, I think maybe one season of Game of Thrones I could possibly say that, but otherwise, no. And it's good TV, you know. But as far as just a nice little 8-episode series, solid. I mean, super solid. I mean, this when we do our best of the year at the end of the year, I'm pretty sure this is going to be ranking pretty high. I would be very surprised if it doesn't rank, you know, I mean, I'm not saying it's number one or not, because there's a lot more. We've got a couple great shows on the horizon just in a couple weeks, plus, you know, not to mention for the rest of the year. But this, for me, I love when every year it seems there's that one or two series that even if I knew about them ahead of time, they still surprise me with how good they are. And right now, this is one of them.
Yeah, I think we lucked into we ended up podcasting a show we hadn't given any thought to, and it ended up working really well, being worth our time. So I'd say FX is definitely, they're probably as high as it gets for a show, networks producing like really, really good TV at this moment. I'd say they might even be the best.
Yeah, I mean, they're so varied in what they're putting out for the last few years. I mean, and it runs the gamut. I mean, granted, there are shows on FX that I've lost interest in or just don't like anymore, like American Horror Story or something like that. But, you know, from the ashes of Justified, you've got Fargo now. You've got The Americans continuing to be, in many people's view, the best series on television. I'd say it ranks right up there. I certainly loved it the best last year. You got this. You got The People versus O.J. Simpson last year. Feud, which is on right now, is so much darn fun, especially if you're into, like, you know, old Hollywood stuff. It's really worthwhile just for that purpose. And, you know, there's probably going to be other shows coming on FX upcoming. I think they were advertising one, which looked kind of intriguing, about the, you know, the beginnings of the crack epidemic in the 80s. I think that's going to be a show coming up, which I might give a shot. Cool. It's got a little bit of kind of a Wire kind of look to it, so I'm a little bit curious about it.
FX seems to have a pretty, you know, really good really good place for, you know, creators to go and be creative, and it's definitely, you know, it can be a showcase for, you know, good acting and good whatever. I'm just glad that shows like this can end up being like, they feel like, you know, the creator is trying to indulge us instead of just trying to like indulge their own ego, you know, as we saw with like Sons of Anarchy and probably some other stuff. But it's just, you know, it's just nice to see that, you know, that they've kind of, you know, given these people a blank check, and they're trying to like do a really good job entertaining us like the best way they can, instead of just, you know, stroke off.
Right. Yeah. And even with Sons of Anarchy, at least for a while there, that was a really good series. And then, as you say, it kind of it went off the rails with a bit. But, and I think Kurt Sutter's ego got the best of him. And that's when we got the infamous episode bloat, where every episode has to be 90-something minutes long, and we have to hear Katie Sagal sing in every episode and have endless musical montages and whatnot. But other than that, it's also exciting to see that FX can have a bunch of good shows over the last couple of years, and they don't have to have Walton Goggins on them, as much as I love Walton Goggins. But I joke. So, back to Legion. I mean, who was your favorite character on the show? I'm just curious.
God, I don't know. I'd have to think about it. I suppose Sid.
See, the character that I have the biggest crush on is Sid. Oliver is probably the most entertaining character on the show, though. So I'm kind of torn between how I choose between those two. But I think Sid has my heart, though. So I'll probably go with her, but Oliver is definitely the funniest one.
Yeah, I mean, it's easy to have a crush on Sid, but just the fact that she's really competent and, like you said earlier, savvy, you know, and just kind of has good instincts. It's nice to see somebody in a show, well, yeah, in a show that's somewhat comic-related, like actually making, like, smart decisions and seeing what's going on and, you know, not needing the smart scientific character to explain what's going on to them.
I love that they did that, yeah.
Yeah, it's something we don't often, you know, we never see anything like that in the DC shows. Like, the characters never know what the hell's going on or remember what happened last season other than to, like, punish themselves over it.
Right. And speaking of other shows and whatever, so on this one, obviously the villain of the series was, you know, the Shadow King, but most often it was manifest as this evil version of Lenny. So when I think of the villain of the series, I think more of that persona rather than the more grotesque looking blobby thing, which we only saw him even speak as that character a few times. So I think it was more about the Aubrey Plaza performance. So,
oh, yeah.
As far as villains go, how does she stack up? And we can think of, like, all the other Marvel TV stuff, like from Netflix or movies or whatever, or even the DC stuff, even though it's really not as relevant here. Because I'm thinking she ranks pretty high.
Yeah, I mean, she's definitely a different kind of character than, like, you know, Magneto or something. But as it comes to this kind of character that's just kind of, like, super chaotic, I mean, you know, the great performance really helps, but just, like, the way that this character was able to, like, manifest in these different ways and just, like, the shitty stuff it was doing it definitely ranks pretty highly.
Yeah, I would at the very least put her on the same level as Kilgrave in the Jessica Jones series.
He was
David Tennant was one of the best things about that season, which I love that season anyway, but he was probably one of the best things about it. And maybe I would just rank it higher only because I was more surprised by what Aubrey Plaza pulled off, because I just did not expect that from her. I just was surprised by it. And just what she did in last week's episode and the whole silent movie thing, I mean, I'll always have that image in my mind of her, you know, cocking her head to the side. I mean, it's so awesome. It's like, that's a movie moment. You know, it reminds me, I know this is going to be a bizarre connection to make. When I was a kid, one of my favorite things I remember seeing in the movies is when I went to go see the second Alien movie, Aliens, right? There's a moment towards the end of that movie. There's this whole sequence that happens with these big elevator lifts. And, you know, one opens, one closes, and Sigourney Weaver just gets away. But then, without her knowing it, the other door opens in front of the big Queen Mother Alien. And just the way the Queen Mother Alien just kind of cocks its head to look at it, you know, it's one of those few moments where they gave this creature, like, a personality, like, So for some reason, like, I'm kind of imagining, like, both those moments together, because they both kind of shift their head in the same bizarre way for some reason. But, yeah, this was a lot of fun to talk about. It was great to actually talk about a series that kind of had a certain mystery element to it, so we could, you know, theorize a little bit here and there or spend an inordinate amount of time wondering what the hell is going on, but enjoying that, because we talk about a lot of TV shows and some great ones, like, you know, like Better Call Saul or Fargo, but they don't really work in that way. They don't go that way. So I like that we actually got a chance to talk about a show of that nature for a change, because the only other show I could think of that's even remotely like that we don't really talk about on our podcast would maybe be Mr. Robot, perhaps. But other than that, I can't really think of any other shows out there that kind of have that kind of feeling or format to them. Oh, I guess Westworld. Anyway.
But no, you know, we were able, just like all the other shows we like to talk about, we were able to appreciate great performances and really good technical prowess behind the scenes and, you know, cool plot and good writing and that kind of stuff. But it's definitely nice to be able to, you know, theorize and bounce theories back and forth. Because we don't often get to do that, other than just making some, like, bold predictions for the future.
Right.
Why hasn't Chuck burnt the house down yet? Damn it.
Oh, Michael McKean was just on Colbert the other day, and I got excited all over again about Better Call Saul just watching a clip from the show. Even though it was a clip from last season, I'm pretty sure. I was like, oh my God, Better Call Saul's coming back. I'm so happy. So yeah, this was a fine series to talk about. And hey, I wish we had more TV shows that we could talk about that only ran 8 episodes. It would take a lot of the load off of. Especially with what's coming up, because we've got both Fargo and Better Call Saul coming up. So I think quite often we may be just be merging those podcasts, as I think I mentioned in our previous podcast. But we are pretty much we're closing the book on Legion now. We're not. I don't think we're going to have the energy to do a follow-up. Oh, more thoughts on last week's episode. You got our thoughts this week. That's enough for you. So I think it's time to wrap this sucker up once and for all. Make sense?
Yep.
All right. So if you enjoyed this podcast, chances are you'll enjoy hanging out on our Facebook page as well. You can find us on Facebook. We're the Serious TV Drama Podcast. Type that in, like the page, and join the conversation about shows like Legion and so many others. You can also find us on iTunes the very same way. Type in the Serious TV Drama Podcast on iTunes. You can subscribe to our feed as well as rate and review us there. And finally, you can also follow us on Twitter. Our handle is at STVD Podcast. That's at STVD Podcast. STVD. Don't I usually spell it out? Serious TV Drama. People know what I'm saying. Shut up. And, I am tired, and it's so early in the morning. So I am excited that we got to get this sucker done and enjoy talking about Legion with you, sir, and looking forward to talking to you later this evening about a bunch of other shows, some of which have actually been pretty good this week.
Good week. Good week for TV for us.
I haven't even seen one of the four shows as of yet, but I would say I'm very pleased with at least two of them. Spoiler again. Anyway, so good night or good morning to you, Dan.
Yep, good afternoon, Scott.
There.